This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. In 1980, the median size of a newly constructed house was 1,600 square feet. In 2001, it was 500 square feet larger. Over that same period of time, the median family's real income changed little. What does this mean? Does it mean we're worried about status, about prestige? Does it mean we're trying to keep up with the millionaires and billionaires over the next ridge? Our guest in this portion of the program asks us to take a closer look at the question. Our guest is economist Robert H. Frank. Here's a quick take on what he sees is going on. Frank says families are feeling pressured to buy more expensive homes because more expensive neighborhoods tend to have better schools. Frank examines the pressures facing middle-class families in his book, Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Robert Frank is Henrietta Johnson Lewis Professor of Management and Professor of Economics at Cornell University. He's contributed op-ed pieces and articles of general interest for many publications, including the New York Times. His previous books include What Price the Moral High Ground, The Winner-Take-All Society, and The Economic Naturalist. We spoke with him about that last book, The Economic Naturalist, in July of this year, July 2007. Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class is published by the University of California Press. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Robert Frank, good to talk with you again. How are you?
Yeah, nice to be back on your show, Celeste.
Nice to talk with you. Well, let's get some idea, a little bit background here. This comes from early in the book, Falling Behind, where you let us know that from 1945 until the end of the 1970s, incomes grew at about the same rate for all income classes. So I think what we need to do is talk about how the rate of growth has changed since then and what happened at the close of the 70s.
Yeah, there were really a couple of things. As you point out, the growth rate of income was the same up and down the income ladder. It was almost 3% a year, and that was, by historical standards, actually a fairly robust growth rate. The overall growth rate has been lower in the decades since then. But more important, there's been a huge shift in the pattern of income growth, so that ever since probably the early 70s, we've got good data for some of the comparisons from the late 70s. But from the early 70s onward, the shift that occurred was that very little income growth went to people outside the top part of the income distribution. So if you look at the median family, you know, we continue to hear arguments about how much they've gained, but everybody concedes that it wasn't nearly as much as during the earlier period, anywhere from 15 to 30% over a several-decade span, which by historical standards, very low growth. People at the bottom of the income ladder, even worse. The only really significant growth you see is in the top fifth during the last several decades. But that's really even misleading because within the top fifth, most of the gains have come in the top 1%. Then you divide that group up and you see most of the gains in the top 1% occurred in the top 0.1%. And so it seems to keep pyramiding up.
Why?
You know, it's a complicated story, but I think there are some common threads that we see running through many different occupations and industries. You know, CEO pay is, I think, a nice case study. The CEOs of large corporations in 1980, we've got fairly good data on their salaries because Business Week tracks them year by year. They earned about 42 times as much as the average worker in 1980. Recently, that ratio is more than 500 times. So really more than tenfold growth on the part of CEOs of large companies during those decades. And So why have they been getting so much more? I think there are a couple of factors that we're starting to see consensus on. One is that markets have grown a lot more competitive over the last three decades. The globe has shrunk, in effect. We can transport things over much larger distances. Communications technology is vastly superior to what it was then. People know where the best products are. They know how to get at them. If you're somebody who can turn a company around, well, there are many more companies who know who you are and are prepared to bid for your services. It used to be that companies really were regional in scope, maybe national, but more and more the norm is for companies to do business around the world. And so as a result of all that, a good decision at the top of the organization has a lot more leverage than it used to. If it's a good decision compared to what others would have made, the bottom line grows by more. Conversely, if you make a bad decision, then the bottom line is hurt by much more than in the old days. And so CEOs just seem to matter more to the organization's fate than they used to because of the greater scope and competition. The other thing that's changed is that we didn't used to have really an openly competitive market for CEO talent. So if you wanted to be the CEO of GM, for example, you had to have spent your whole career there. I don't know if you remember Michael Moore's film, Roger and Me, but he chronicled the General Motors CEO, Roger Smith, who was head of the company for 11 years, despite turning in what by all accounts was very lackluster performance for the company. He didn't get paid as much as today's CEOs. Today's CEOs are recruited in an open market. And so really I think the landmark case was when IBM thought to hire RJR's former CEO, Louis Gerstner. They brought him over. He had no experience in the computer industry. In the old days, nobody would have dreamed of making a move like that. But they thought, and it, as it turned out rightly, that if you're really good at finance, if you're really good at marketing, if you understand how to motivate people, then there are tech people for the details. And so he turned IBM, the struggling computer giant, around. He was paid hundreds of millions of dollars during his tenure, but he was worth much more than that to the company.
At the same time, there have been a lot of these highly paid CEOs who have turned in pretty lackluster performances.
Yeah, that's the other side of the coin. Football coaches get paid a lot. Half of them lose every Saturday. So, you know, it's true that there's a going rate in every category. And the more competitive the market becomes, the more the financial stakes are in the position, then the higher the going rate gets. But then as the going rate goes up, the leash gets shorter. So there's no way on earth Roger Smith would have survived for 11 years in today's climate. CEOs at the top of the General Motors Corporation last a year or two if they're not turning in good numbers. So I think that's the trade we've seen. The numbers have been bid up. Nobody wants to announce to the world that they've just hired a mediocre CEO. Everybody knows that half the CEOs are below average, but nobody wants to, you know, we're all hoping for the best when we hire one, and then we wait and see. If they don't turn in the numbers, then it's the next in line.
Yeah. Boy, though, you know, the two of us, though, if we were headed out the door tomorrow, we're not going to be headed out with the kind of a package that some of these folks.
That's right.
Yeah.
They get a nice termination package, so losing your job isn't as painful as it was. But remember, when they're hired, the executive board that chose them as the next candidate really had high hopes that they would be the person to make the company's fortune soar. And so the candidate was in a pretty strong bargaining position on day one. If other companies are prepared to give big severance packages, then why should a CEO accept a job that doesn't have one? That's just the way the market seems to be headed.
Okay. Well, now let's talk about the shift in the pattern of income growth on the middle class, the folks who are underneath that top group of folks, and the impact that it has on housing and what kind of housing middle class Americans are looking for these days.
Yeah, as you said, Celeste, at the top of the program, it's certainly not the case that people seem to be trying to copy the mega mansions of the millionaires and billionaires. I mean, people in the middle class don't aspire to own mansions. It would be a totally unrealistic aspiration in any event. It's also interesting, I think, that in America, there's no evidence whatsoever that people in the middle get angry at the idea that the people at the top of the income ladder are building houses of 50, 60, 70,000 square feet. They seem, on the contrary, interested in seeing pictures of them. They want to sort of celebrate the good fortunes of the rich, which is, I think, a nice thing about living in the U.S. That said, though, the houses at the top that people are building, these large mansions that have been springing up all around, have had an effect on people in the middle. It's just been an indirect effect. So if you think about the people just below the very top earners, the top earners have built bigger. That changes the custom in their circle. I don't know, maybe they have dinner parties for 36, not 24. Maybe it's now the custom to have your daughter's wedding reception at home rather than in a club or a hotel. So people who are close to the wealthy who travel in those same circles, they build bigger too. But then they have a circle of friends that overlaps up and down. So there's a group below them for whom the frame of reference shifts. Suddenly what constitutes adequate housing for them gets jacked up a notch. They build bigger, and that cascade goes all the way down the income ladder. You cited the figure, 1,600 square feet, the median new house built in 1980, up to 2,100 square feet by 2001. The first quarter of this year was up to 2,300 square feet. You know, that's a huge increase in the median new house. The people in the middle didn't build bigger because they had much more money. They didn't. The land's more expensive. They can't afford the kinds of mortgages that it takes to carry that house, as we're indeed seeing now with the mortgage meltdown. But they felt pressure nonetheless to keep up with community spending standards because of the link between schools and house spending. You know, if you don't buy a house that's roughly the average in price for your area, your children are unfortunately going to go to below-average schools in most communities.
Yeah. Now, here's a question that I have, though. Couldn't families forego the bigger house, the better neighborhood, and invest in a private education, or forego a second income and homeschool?
Well, you do see families foregoing the second income and homeschooling. Not every family is going to want to do that. Not every family would be competent to do that. We demand of teachers that they be certified. There are lots of different subjects for kids to learn. It's very rare once you get out of elementary school that a single teacher would be really well qualified to teach the mix of subjects we expect students to get good at before they go file their college applications. So I think that's not really an option for too many families. You can buy a house in a cheaper neighborhood, but sending a child to private school, that's the difference between the mortgage on the more expensive house and the tuition to the private school. Sometimes there are private schools that are within reach of the average family's budget, but often those too are beyond affordability status.
Yeah. Also, it raises the question, you know, what do these choices mean for our system of public education? You know, are we impoverishing our public schools if this is what it's coming down to?
You know, the income distribution shifts we've seen have put people in the middle under such pressure that it's been very hard for them to tolerate tax increases to keep up with the needs of school systems in their areas. So you see bond measures are routinely now voted down. And as a result of that, the salaries of public school teachers, they used to be about 120% of a starting college graduate salary. Now they're under 100% of a starting college graduate's salary. And what happens as a result of that is that the kinds of people who choose teaching as a career have steadily the shift in qualifications has been palpable. We see lower SAT scores, lower rank in class. The mix of people who are choosing teaching now is just not what it was in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah. There's also an amusing one of the cartoons that you've included in Falling Behind from The New Yorker involves a fellow standing around talking to some younger chaps and saying, let me see if I can find it here quickly in the book. I know you young guys have a hard time believing it, but there was a time, and not all that long ago, when a man telling a woman he was in investment banking could expect a yawn.
Yeah, that's really such a clear encapsulation of the change in ethos that's gone on. Not that people are different. You know, I think people always looked for where the opportunities were, but the difference in salary between the players, the people who are in these handful of key positions in every sector, and everyone else has gotten so large that it's really become a much bigger factor in life choices. You see all sorts of people rearranging what they do to have a better shot at one of these trophy jobs.
And a trophy spouse.
A trophy spouse, that's right. Yeah, I met somebody at a conference on the West Coast a couple of years ago. He told me he had gone from full-time to half-time status at the law school where he taught, and he wanted to spend more time up at his family's cabin in the Sierras and do some writing. And he said he wanted to remarry. He'd been divorced for a few years, and he said he would meet people at social gatherings, and the moment he revealed that he was teaching half-time, he said you could feel a curtain drop. People who he thought he had an interesting conversation going with right up until that moment suddenly seemed to want to get out of the conversation. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think people often aren't aware, but they're looking for evidence that someone's a player now, and it's just harder and harder to cross that divide for people.
Yeah, so that poor chap is seen as a loser.
Unfortunately, yeah. And actually a very interesting guy doing interesting things.
So what
but
does
not a player.
Yeah. So, and this maybe we can talk now about the impact on our quality of life. This fellow made some choices, so he has the kind of life that he wants to live. Others of us perhaps are, you know, taking another tack. And, you know, let's talk about how these choices that we're forced to make or the pressures that we have on us affect, say, our health or the amount of time we spend with family or the amount of leisure time we have, the time we spend commuting in the car, all kinds
right.
of things.
Yeah, if you think about the house figure, I think that's the salient one. The fact that people have to carry so much larger mortgages now than in the past, that's forced them to work every conceivable margin to try and make ends meet. It's not just the house. You know, if you're interviewing for a job, you want to look good. The other candidates who want the same job you do are wearing nicer clothing now than 30 years ago because of an expenditure cascade ultimately launched by the higher spending of top earners. You've got to spend more now on an interview suit or else have a lower chance than before of getting the call back. Others are buying bigger vehicles because of the same sort of expenditure cascade. You've got to buy a bigger one or else risk a higher probability of your family getting seriously injured or killed in an auto accident. So there are all these extra demands, gifts for important social occasions. Others are spending more. You feel you must spend more or else send a signal you don't think it's an important occasion. So if you want to meet those demands, how do you do it if you're not earning as much as before? And the short answer is that people are forced to work almost every margin available. So commuting longer distances, we see a much bigger increase in the number of long commutes in most urban areas. People working second jobs, people working longer hours, people saving less for retirement than before. The level of debt that consumers are carrying, that skyrocketed too. Bankruptcies are rising. It's a very difficult thing for the family in the middle to make ends meet, and I think the mistake is to think that they're just being undisciplined. You know, I think the common criticism here is, oh, well, if they can't afford Gucci handbags and Prada loafers, they just shouldn't buy those things. Well, that's right. It's good advice, but that's not really the problem of people in the middle. Mm. You know, they're just trying to buy a suit that's presentable for their interview. They're trying to get a safe car. They're trying to buy a house in a decent school district, and the cost of doing that has skyrocketed because of the higher spending at the top.
Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, Robert H. Frank. He is a professor of management and a professor of economics at Cornell University. We're talking with him this afternoon about the ideas in his book, Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, let's take a call now, a listener calling in from Northern Illinois, line four, the toll-free line in Elburn. Hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Good topic. Actually, right down my alley. I'm in the service industry. I'm almost, but out of business, basically. Well, I consider myself out of business after about 20 years. I'm basically a close-up shop and go do something else. People don't have the money to spend anymore, like you were saying. A lot of it has to do, though, I think, personally, on the towns and especially out here where I'm at, the overdevelopment. And I've seen this because when I moved out here 15 years ago, I moved in here and property taxes and the housing area was really cheap to live in. Now it's astronomical. I'm probably paying triple, almost quadruple since I've lived in here in property taxes. And it's strictly because of overbuilding. But now we got left holding the bag with this giant size development that they have out this way. As far as mall strip malls and commercial buildings and whatnot, and the houses that are left standing that nobody can afford to buy. And plus, the dollar has shrunk to an all-time low. The cost of everybody's paycheck is, you don't get a raise, but the cost of living keeps going up. Everything's going up. The cost of gas, the gas solely affects everything out there in the market. It's not just what you put in your car. It's what you buy at the store. It's right. The plastic bags. It's, because gasoline's only a quarter of that 55-gallon drum of oil that's being used out there. I mean, I've seen this over and over, and I don't know. I mean, I'm middle, but I'm slowly sinking backwards. I have to go back to working two and three jobs now. And I was making a comfortable living. This just happened in the last 4 or 5 years.
It's a common story.
Pardon?
It's a common story, yeah. It's all too common, the story you're telling.
But I feel, okay, I don't know if it is the same out there, but I feel a lot of our politicians, you know, they like to spend our money, and they don't, all these little frivolous things that they want to spend them on, how come we have to take care of our own checkbook and keep our checks and balances, but they don't? I mean, I see this on a common basis all the time up here with local municipalities and local counties. They want to spend money, get more land bought up for forest preserve and whatnot, but yet, you know, we don't have enough money to take care of some of the road maintenance out here, for instance.
Right.
And I think it's just ludicrous. It's about time that they start checking their budgets, and we could do without some of this stuff now.
Yeah, I'm gonna jump in here because we got so many issues on the table. And I don't know where you want to start.
Yeah, I think if you look at the budgets locally, at the state level, federally, there's a similarity that we see across those levels of government, and it's that people are unwilling or unable to pay for basic services. At the same time, we're demanding tax cuts, not for people in the middle. People in the middle have gotten very little tax relief in the last 10 years. It's people at the top of the income ladder that have been getting the real tax relief. You look at the special tax treatment of people at the very top. The hedge fund manager at the top of the list earned $1.7 billion last year. It's a high salary, to be sure. It's got the look and feel of ordinary income. Yet that income was taxed at the rate of 15%. You and I pay a much higher rate of tax than that now, closer to 35 or 40%. And those aren't tax cuts that we can give without having adverse consequences for services that people in the middle rely on without having adverse consequences for interest rates, for the dollar, and so on. They're not even really tax cuts. They're loans from China, Japan, and elsewhere that will have to be repaid in full. Our children will end up footing the interest and the principal on those loans. And the money doesn't really seem to have gone to any particularly pressing purpose for the people who got it. So what we know is that when people build bigger mansions, all of them, it doesn't really seem to have much effect on their happiness levels. You need a certain size mansion in order to signal that your business is healthy. But if everybody spent a little less, then people would be just as happy as they were when everybody spent more. And those dollars certainly could be used to repair bridges. We see lots of bridges that are nearly as in bad shape as the one that collapsed in Minneapolis. We're not inspecting the cargo containers that come into our ports. We cut the budget for the Energy Department's program that rounds up poorly guarded nuclear materials in the former Soviet Union. We couldn't afford to do that, yet we could afford massive tax cuts. It's a very strange situation. I think people will look back 100 years from now and say, well, what were they thinking doing that mix of policies then?
Yeah. Where this gentleman called in from Elburn has just seen unbelievable growth over the last several years. And I wouldn't, maybe not several. I mean, it's just amazing. Right. And it's a far west suburb of Chicago, really far west. Mm. And the thing is it strikes me on the one hand is that we're kind of here in a catch-22, because let's just take a look at, let's say, the local school district there. On the one hand, they've got all this revenue pouring into the school district. So that's good. On the other hand, a fellow like this man is really getting squeezed because his property is being bumped up along with everybody else's.
Right. And a lot of that development was predicated on deregulation that occurred in the financial industry. You know, when I first bought a house, the banks wanted 25% of the purchase price of the house as a down payment. You know, I had a 15-year period to pay off the loan. The terms were fairly strict to be eligible for a loan. You had to have good evidence that you had a salary that would enable you to meet the payments. If your payments were going to be more than about a quarter or a third of your monthly income, then they wouldn't make the loan. All those regulations gradually were abandoned over the last couple of decades. And so people could borrow more, and because they could, they did. And when others borrow more, they bid for the choice areas, the good school districts. Then a family deciding what to do is in a bind. If you don't borrow as much as you can borrow, then your kids are going to end up in schools where other students score in the 15th or 20th percentile in reading and math. So you can't really find fault for parents for borrowing as much as the law allowed them to borrow. But then what we're seeing now is that people just got overextended in the process. So a lot of these communities that have been built on that model are poised to collapse. It's a tragedy.
So in housing, we're seeing that we can't keep going like this. We just have seen, and we are still in the thick of this mortgage meltdown. It seems that we're seeing that this isn't sustainable. So how do we recover?
Yeah, the late Herb Stein had a great quote that's been quoted more and more all the time as the situation emerges. He said that if something can't keep going on forever, it won't. Clearly, we're spending more than we earn. Last year, the savings rate was negative. It was the year before that, too. The first 2 years, that's happened since the Great Depression. We're borrowing $800 billion a year from abroad. These are things that can't continue. We've got a healthcare system that's completely dysfunctional. Everybody agrees with that, too. The only way really to fix the healthcare problem is to have some sort of universal coverage plan where the government steps in and solves the adverse selection problem that's just inherent in private insurance markets. And it won't be more expensive than we now pay to do that, but we will have to shift more revenue onto the central government budget to sustain some of that shift. It'll be meaning that we pay less out of our private pocket, so it'll be a net savings. But still, that will mean to solve all these problems, we need more revenue to be able to get a grip on them, to repair the infrastructure, to pay the teachers, to patch the potholes, to round up the loose nukes, all those things. You need more revenue. And in the U.S. in recent decades, it's been almost impossible to have a civil discussion about tax policy focused on the need to raise as much revenue as the government spends providing basic services. People will say, oh, the government's the source of the problem. We need, the government's your enemy. We need to starve the government. Well, we've been trying that strategy now for a couple of terms here, and the things keep getting cut that aren't the things that maybe should get cut. You know, government budgets are hard to cut. Every program has a constituency. You cut what you can, maybe not what you should cut. And so we're starving the budgets for services we all really care about. So we've got to figure out how to pay for those, and that means stepping up and sort of coming up with ways to shift some of the resources that are now being spent on what by all evidence is low-valued activity, and move those resources, if we can, into activities that will do more for us as a nation, rich and poor alike.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, economist Robert H. Frank. He is the author of Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. You can join us this afternoon. Join the discussion with a question, with a comment. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's take another call now, a listener in Sycamore, line 4. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm just heard a term that you mentioned moments ago about a failed community. And I live near that town of Elburn that you were talking about, and all I see going on over there is farm after farm being turned into plastic suburbia, and amazed when I hear how bad the housing market is. It certainly doesn't look bad over there, so I'm wondering if people who are talking about how bad things are looking in rather selected areas of the country, like the East and West Coast. But around here, things seem like they're going great. What do you think?
Well, it's certainly true that the housing market was much more heated in the coastal regions and in a handful of other areas in the country. So if you look at the multiples income, you know, what fraction of your income do you need to spend on a house? That fraction is much lower in the heartland than on the coast. You're absolutely right. But even in the heartland, now we see people with debt that's well beyond what a family with the median income can comfortably sustain. And with the terms of borrowing that were made available to families, we're seeing now even in the heartland many overextended families, many foreclosures, many bankruptcy filings.
Does the caller want to follow
up? I don't know the particular community that the earlier caller referred to, but there are many communities where that is true.
Well, when you said a failed community, then does that mean that the place is going to become like a ghost town?
That won't happen in most communities, no, but there are some communities in which that's happened. But the prospect is for things to get worse rather than better in the short term. Most of the consumer spending that's been propping up demand in the economy the last 3 or 4 years, or a good chunk of it at any rate, has come from people refinancing their houses, which were rising sharply in price year by year. They would harvest a little equity and then put an addition onto their house or buy an SUV or build a pool or spend it on some consumer good, not out of their income, but out of money borrowed against equity in their houses. Now there's none of that going on. House prices are not rising. On the contrary, they're falling. And so people no longer have equity to harvest out of their home ownership. And so consumer spending is going to be feeling an increasing pinch in the coming months. And it's not clear, with the possibility of a recession looming, that investment spending is going to pick up that slack. So I think we are about to see some of the costs of the policy decisions that we've made in recent years come home to roost.
Very interesting. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Next, we go to Terre Haute, Indiana. Listener on line one. Hi.
Hello. I am enjoying your program. I am a real estate appraiser. I've been appraising real estate for almost 20 years, and I have noted how it has changed when I got into the business. Most of my business came from local lenders who loaned money on local properties, and they knew their customers and clients, and they tended to be properties that were going up on the market and had sold. And over the years, that has completely changed. And my job now, the bulk of my business comes from lenders out of town who are financing refis. And so I have the have had the task of attempting to trying to predict what is a realistic value that a property might sell for. Of course, the purpose of that property is for real estate financing or for refinancing. And how difficult of a job that is. And invariably, too frequently, my value was not what was anticipated, and the job fell through. My feeling was that more often than none, those individuals seeking financing and those brokers or out-of-town lenders would simply go somewhere else and until they found an opinion that would support what they were looking for.
Oh, that's exactly the incentives that were set up. Yeah, if you're shopping for an opinion on what your house is worth, and the appraisers, I mean, that puts you in an impossible position, as you realize. If you give an honest estimate and others give an estimate that's shaded up by 3 to 5%, then you don't get the contract. They do. And so there's always a gray area, and so there's pressure on the most honest appraiser to go up that 3 to 5%. But then that sets a new baseline, and somebody goes up 5% above that, and so others start losing business to that person. So there's another round of escalation, and it, in the end, becomes an impossible activity to sustain, honestly. You just can't compete for business unless you give an inflated forecast of what a property is worth.
Yeah,
very tough position.
Yes, and I have always said that. Of course, it's very difficult for one to predict what a property would sell for. And when I look at comps, when I look at other properties that are similar that have sold, my feeling is that what those properties have sold for have always been kind of skewed by the fact that they may have had in the equation when they sold some irresponsible financing to begin with. In other words, the seller needs a certain amount to get out from under a loan. They list it. It gets lucky. It sells. And so you have kind of a skewed number, something that may be a little higher than it really should be.
And the ones that don't get lucky don't sell.
Yes.
So they don't enter the calculation when they look at the averages.
Exactly. It is too frequently pure and simple luck when a property does sell. And occasionally you will find a property. I have been involved in estate sales where you have had couples that have owned a home, have not over the life of the home refinanced, and occasionally a home comes on the market and sells realistically, and that is so infrequent but so wonderful to have been involved in a transaction that is a fair transaction. I do appreciate your program on this today.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for the call this afternoon. Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. Our guest this afternoon, Robert H. Frank. Well, what is the here's something that I think is an interesting thing to talk about. The effect on wealth, long-term effect on wealth for individuals and for the whole, for us collectively.
You know, if you want to end up wealthier than you start out, there's really only one recommended path, and that is to save as much as you can responsibly year by year. That's actually a very reliable way to see your wealth grow because of the miracle of compound interest. The elementary school teachers like to demonstrate the idea by saying, imagine a paramecium on the first square of a checkerboard. It has two daughters, so you got two on the next square. They each have two daughters, you got four on the next square. And so by the time you let that process roll out to the 64th square of the checkerboard, you've got so many paramecia that they'd elbow to elbow make three or four round trips to the sun. It's just an enormously powerful process. If you put money in the bank at 7%, and the stock market's actually grown at 11 or 12% over the last century, you're going to see your money double in 10 years. And just putting aside 10, 15, 20% of your paycheck, if you can each year, is the very surest path to seeing your wealth grow. We, as I say, have not been doing that at all. We've been spending more than we earn. So I think now families are experiencing the miracle of compound interest exactly in reverse. Mm-hmm. They're paying interest every year, not getting interest every year. Students are graduating with $25,000, $30,000 worth of college loans. Right when they should be building up their nest eggs for the future, they're having to pay out monthly payments plus stiff interest. So I think we've got to change that somehow.
Yeah. We only have a couple of minutes left, and one of the things that you write about in Falling Behind, and also you did a column earlier this year, this fall, October 2007, for the New York Times, is your idea for incentives to help us along with this idea of spend less, save more, and that is a progressive consumption tax. And I'll give your website here at the end of the time, but maybe you could tell us just a little bit about your idea for you know, prodding us into spending less and saving more.
Yeah, the idea basically is that we're not stupid. We know perfectly well what's in our interest and what isn't. It's just that sometimes what we see as the best choice open to us as an individual is different from what would be best for us as a group. There's the familiar stadium metaphor. Everybody stands to see better. Nobody sees any better if they'd all remain seated. And I think that's the characteristic of many spending decisions that we make. We need a bigger mansion because others have a bigger mansion, and we don't want to be seen as somebody with a failing business, for example. Mm-hmm. So if you're a well-to-do person, if you're thinking carefully about your own interests, you ought to be very favorably disposed to an idea to help stall that arms race. The mansions are getting bigger. No one's any happier. That same money could be spent for things that would be of much greater value to you and your neighbors than the mansions that you're building. Well, you can't just expect people to voluntarily cut back. Others build bigger and you don't. Well, then your house is second rate. But it would be possible to adopt a policy that would give everybody in common an incentive to scale back, and that's the progressive consumption tax. So you just scrap the income tax system we have now entirely in its place. Report your income to the tax authorities much as you do now, then report your savings for the year. We know how to do that, too, because we do it for 401k plans and other similar retirement savings vehicles. Then your income minus your savings is what you spent during the year. That's your consumption this year. Then subtract from that a big standard deduction, let's say $30,000 for a family of four, and that's your taxable consumption. And so if you're a $50,000 income earner and you save $5,000 and you have the $30,000 standard deduction, your taxable consumption would be $50,000 minus $5,000 minus $30,000 or $15,000. Tax would be very low on people with that low level of consumption, maybe 10%. So you'd pay about $1,500 in tax. But then as you consume more, as people start spending more and more, the tax you pay on the additional dollars you spend goes up, and it could go up sharply. So if you're spending already $5 million a year, the rate on additional consumption could be 100%. So that would be a very powerful incentive to not build as big a wing on the mansion next time. Your neighbors would face the same incentive. You'd each build a smaller wing. You'd build a wing, perhaps, and then you'd pay tax on that. That would help repair the bridges you drive across on your way into the city. But in the meantime, the size of the houses built at the top would grow more slowly. The expenditure cascade that puts pressure on people in the middle would be made less intense as a result of that. And everybody would come out ahead compared to if we did nothing. Hmm. So I think it's the kind of tax that rich, middle, and poor ought to really like. I proposed this tax in an article in 1997, and I got a very warm letter from Milton Friedman, the conservative Nobel laureate. He said he had proposed precisely the same tax himself in 1943 during World War II, and he sent me a reprint of his article in the 1943 American Economic Review in which he'd made that proposal. And so I think it's the kind of tax that conservatives could get behind. Liberals could get behind it, too. We need more revenue if we're going to have universal health care. We've got to come up with that revenue somewhere. So why not take it from those spending activities that are least urgent? And I think if you're spending already $5 million a year, the next thing you buy really is something you buy because others have it. It's just what's expected of people in your circle. It would be very easy not to spend that next dollar and instead use it either to invest, which you could do tax-free, or spend it and pay tax on it, which could be used to finance things that would benefit you more than everybody building bigger.
I can only give you about 30 seconds for this question, but I got to ask it. Okay. You know, if this is such a great idea and it goes back, you know, it's been out there in one form or another since the 1940s, why don't we have it?
Yeah, it's a great question. If you're so smart, why aren't you rich? You know, this proposal was made in the Senate in 1995. It had bipartisan sponsorship. Sam Nunn and Pete Domenici offered it. Warren Buffett came out in an interview with Tom Brokaw a couple of weeks ago. He proposed a progressive consumption tax. If we're really serious about tackling the mix of problems we have, there's no better way to get revenue to pay the bill. And that's the question. Are we serious or not? So listen in when the campaign unfolds. Is anybody serious here?
Okay. There we've got to leave it. We're out of time. Robert Frank, thank you very much for talking with me.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
Robert H. Frank is a professor of management and professor of economics at Cornell University. He is the author of one of his books, Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. And you can read some of his writings and find out more about him at his website. It is www.robert-h-frank.com. And our thanks this afternoon to our technical director at Cornell this afternoon, Colbert McClellan.